Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome Franklin Sanders back to the Salieri Report. On today is Thursday, October 9th, and Franklin and I are going to be talking about spiritual warfare, but Franklin agreed to do a special segment just on precious metals, and because the precious metals market has been particularly fascinating this last 2 weeks, I appreciate his willingness to do this, and so I wanted to take the time to do it. So, Franklin, what a 2 weeks. Why don't you bring us current on what's been happening in the precious metals market?
Well, you know, it's not just with precious metals, but in every market, it's investors, whoever they are, moving the market, have become so fickle and so shallow-minded that the only thing apparently that drives them is one thing. They begin to fix on one statistic, one item of data, and that's all they think about. And lately it's been the dollar. And the more they think about it, the more they pile into it because they're just following momentum. If you look at the long-term dollar chart, you see that the dollar made a big high in 2001 and 2002 at about 120, and then went into this long, long downfall down to 71.33 in 2008, and then it's gone sideways ever since, forming one of those long, even-sided triangles. You don't know which, don't tell you how it will break out and resolve. But in any event, recently it broke out higher than it's been in 4 years. And you can see I've got question marks there. Is it going to go higher? Is it going to go up to, say, 92, which is where the horizontal resistance is? If you look at the shorter-term chart, you see that the dollar formed this little head-and-shoulders complex over the period from about March to July, and then it broke out going upwards, and it got as high as 86.87, and now in the last couple of days it's broken back down. So apparently it's going to go down. But the question that remains with that dollar hanging over the market is this just a correction in a much longer upward move that will take it up to 92 and last a year or so, or has this finished? And the thing is that in general terms, in long terms, the gold price, gold and silver price, are the reciprocal of the dollar price, just like the dollar price is the reciprocal of the euro price. So right now, this is what's driving the market. This is what people are looking at as the one cosmic piece of information that controls everything, although we know that's not true. Then if you look at the long-term gold chart, what you see is that if you take the monthly chart all the way back to 2001, you've got this long uptrend line, and in the last 3 years, gold has traded back to that uptrend line, and now last week just closed right on that line, that uptrend line. So what this enables us to say is this better be the end of it. This better be the end of that correction, because if gold falls through that long-term uptrend line, then it would imply that it's going to go way on down, maybe.
Right. So if it breaks the 1200 or 1100 line, it could go back down to 700 or 800.
That's a possibility, right? I mean, that's what right. You have to say, because those long term trend lines are very important. But you see this pattern, and you've seen this pattern before. That's the kind of midlife crisis that a bull market has, where in the middle it falls down, looks like it's dead, and then all of a sudden it rises up again. Same thing happened with stocks in 1987. In the bull market that went from 82 to 2000, there was a big crash in 87. Everybody thought that was the end of it, and then it came back. Same thing with gold and silver in 1975 through 76. So that's a kind of typical pattern in bull markets. If you look at the short-term gold chart, what you see is I've got up there in the upper right-hand corner at 1350, fish or cut bait. And that's what gold has to do at that 1350 line. In a sense, all the rest of what it does heading, you know, moving higher is just noise until it crosses that 1350 line. So you can see that it broke down out of the uptrend that had carried it from the end of December of 2013. It broke down there where there's an arrow that says breakdown, traded down, and then it made a key reversal in the last 3 days. And it has now closed above its 20-day moving average, and the MACD has turned up. So it's rallying from here, but how high it will get, we don't know. There's not, again, this is kind of meaningless until we get over 1224, and then you have to jump over 1300 after that. But the real test is going to come up there at 1350.
See, I think the real test is 1530.
Well, it is after that, because 1530 right. is where it broke off in 2013. But for right now, that last high at 1350 is, if it can't make it through that, you know, the rest, we're just.
Well, let me go through some of the things that are going on, because it's, you know, clearly what's happening with the dollar and precious metals is at the heart of a global economic dynamic, which is quite fierce and is probably going to get fiercer. And the struggle I have, Franklin, and I know you have, is when you're dealing in a global financial system, which is first and foremost, we don't really understand who's in control and what they're up to, other than spiritually. And so the governance system isn't clear, and the goals of the governance system we can guess at, but they're still not clear. But clearly you've got a group of people who are trying to centralize control. And when you have a situation that is this centralized and leveraged and managed, the variability of what can happen, you know, the markets are not regrounding to fundamentals every day. And so things can get...
They're not regrounding to fundamentals at all.
Go
ahead.
I think they are regrounding to fundamentals in the sense that every time, you know, if you look at all commodity prices, when the price goes down for whatever reason, people can buy. And so because you can still transact, there's some kind of grounding. It's more in some markets than others. But, so I think there is some, but the problem is, again, the variability of what can happen if they were to regrant to fundamentals is very wide, and it can be unnerving. And if you look at the charts for both precious metals and the dollar, you know, we've seen technicians who, and I think they're very good technicians, have said, you know, if this goes this way, you could see the dollar, I would say it's much higher than 92, you could see it go into the hundreds again, and we could see precious metals. We've had some technicians say 700, 800, you know, you talked about if we break the 1100 line, it drops. And the problem is, you know, if we were regrounding to fundamentals, we wouldn't be having these conversations, because you'd never have variability that wide. And if you look at what's driving that kind of politics, we have two things going on. You have a group of people trying to centralize power, and the more they do that, the more they kill the economy. So whether it's the desire to bring Russia into the, you know, the pro-centralization team control and Russia resisting, or, you know, efforts to get the BRICS to do what G7 wants, or, you know, forcing Obamacare on Americans, you're doing a wide group of things which are basically destroying economic activity. You know, you're shutting the economy down, and so growth slows down. And part of what's happening with the dollar is a currency devaluation. You know, we're watching a currency war, to me, a la the 30s. Everybody's, as growth slows, their exports drop. So they're trying to, you know, the currencies are falling because they're trying to protect their market share. And you've got a spiral down because you basically have an economy that's being destroyed by people trying to control everything. That's my interpretation of what's going on. And of course, you know, the dollar versus precious metals at the heart of it, because, you know, the dollar is the ultimate taxation tool with which to control. And so, you know, it's the ultimate taxation. In other words, the power of G7, but I'll just, you know, working through the American bureaucracy is, I print money out of air and I trade it with you for real natural resources and real labor, and you've got to play along because I've got a lot of guns. You know, and so to me, what's going to happen, I mean, let's just look, because I'm one of those fools piling people into dollars right now. You know, if you look at for the last 3 to 6 months, I've been shifting people more and more out of risk assets and into fixed income, if you just look at my client base. But the long treasuries at the end of the third quarter was up 16% for the year, and gold was up 1%. And that's, you know, people are looking, and you get no yield in gold, and you get 2%, you know, to 3% in treasuries. And that's why people are going there. But the biggest reason they're going there, Franklin, is they're sick of the war. They're just saying, you know something? I just don't want to lose any money. And so they're going to cash or fixed income because they're just sick of it. Or they're going to real assets. So I'm seeing more and more people interested in saying, you know, I'm just going to buy a piece of land because at least that's there when this is all said and done. So, but, you know, after many years of being sick of this battle, the need of a lot of people for yield is very great. And part of it
for what? Sorry.
The need of investors for income. You know, if I've kept my money in cash for 5 or 10 years, at this point I'm screaming for yield.
Well, and, precisely, and of course that's the function. That's a function of central bank policy, which has been to kill yield to keep interest rates down. That's part of financial repression, so the government can finance
right.
this enormous spending, but. You know, if you look on a larger, if you look, ask yourself, well, what does all this mean for the future? And you think that there are these promoters out there, you know, that the establishment, the people who run things they don't control things, I don't think, in the way that a lot of people think they have absolute control over markets. I think the establishment itself is broken into different groups who have different goals and compete with each
right.
other or struggle against each other. But also you can tell one of the things that they like to do is to send out to develop replacement schemes or antitheses that they throw into the mix to see whether they'll float or not. And one of those that I think that they're pushing out there is the reset theory, that the currency world is going to be, quote, reset, and gold will have some place in that reset. And as examples of the promotion of this, I would point out to the Gold Standard Group that Lou Lehrman is behind and Forbes is promoting, and also that, Jim Rickards, who works for the CIA, who talks openly about working for the CIA, and talks about this reset and how gold will have a part in it and so forth. Now, what I think they're doing is they see that the system as it is, the fiat money system as it is reaching a critical point where it will break down, and therefore they have to have something new to put in its place. And so this is one of the things they might do, and so they're promoting it in advance. So I think that's what's going on.
Right. I agree.
The economic and monetary financial impossibilities or contradictions that surfaced in 2008 are all still there. I mean, this has been a recession without any cure at all. And so people, as you say, are chasing yield. They're looking for safety. And that is seen in this flight into the dollar. And as stocks go down, there'll be more people that flee into the dollar. And it's not just that, but there's a worldwide unrest. There's unrest in Hong Kong. There's unrest in Ukraine. There's unrest in the Middle East. And any one of those situations might blow up and make the euro and other investments, other currencies just drop like a rock.
So, well, but that I would say the three unrests you just mentioned have been engineered.
Oh, I don't doubt. I mean, I'm still
right.
questioning who's behind ISIS. Is it the CIA? Is it the Mossad? Is it both of them working together? Because there just hasn't been an Arab fighting force in the last 50 years that's been as competent as ISIS. clearly they've got...
Well, I would say it's probably Booz Allen Hamilton.
but the point the point that I'm making is there's this gigantic struggle going on, and it's not clear yet how it's going to resolve, because it's not even clear, even with the rally that you've had in the dollar, it's not clear yet that the that it really will climb up to 92, because on this correction it might go down and close under 80. And then,
well, I would describe it very differently, because I think things are very different since the bailout. You know, you had a financial coup d'etat, and a lot of the paper that was, you know, a lot of the fraudulent paper that was issued to finance that has been extinguished or dealt with, which means you have a separation going on. You know, the people who stole 40 trillion plus now have it, and the governments who financed it are now much weaker. And now the people with the 40 trillion are proceeding, and we're in the end game, and nobody knows what that looks like, but it's a highly chaotic period, because you're talking about, you know, the assets being in one group and the liabilities being the other group. And the question is, how are the governments going to manage this end game?
Right. So, I think there's one more thing I want to mention just as a footnote about the mechanics of what's going on here. You know, there was a report published by OMFIF, O-M-F-I-F, believe it or not, which is this trans-global private group that advises central bankers and that kind of functionaries. And in this report, which cost a modest 350 pounds, they said that there are 157 central banks around the world, and 150 some odd other government pension funds, and another 57 sovereign investment funds that have invested in the stock markets of the world and own about 40% of the total stock market capitalization. Now, think about what that means. It means that ownership is being concentrated in government hands. I mean, if they can create money out of nothing, their pockets are deeper than anybody else's pockets in the world.
Well, I would say it differently. I would say that it's being concentrated in centralized hands. So if you look at... Yeah. So if you look, they're using government institutions, just like they've... In the U.S., we now have more than 50% of the market owned by, you know, pension funds and big institutions. So basically what you do is you institutionalize private savings, and then those institutions, whether they're government or government-related or, you know, large private financial institutions, but if you look at who directs the policy, it's private. So all you're seeing is the leadership in and around and behind G7 directing policy, you know, whether it's through the central banks or the equity positions. Now, I'm grossly oversimplifying. But you're centralizing control of the markets. But something else is going on, Franklin, and that is you're printing a ton of money in Europe, in the United States, and that money is basically being used to securitize assets globally. So we, you know, at the beginning of the 90s, we had the total equity market float was $9 trillion. Right now it's $69 trillion, and it's rising, because what you're doing is you're bringing – you know, the assets throughout the emerging and frontier markets into that market. And you're printing paper, and that paper is being soaked up by this process. I mean, it's very clever what they're doing.
Well,
as a financial matter.
By the printing of paper, you're transferring ownership and control of those, of equity, of productive assets, into somebody else's hands.
Right. You're centralizing ownership and control.
Right. And that, now, that's a process that has made huge progress. I mean, if they control 40% of the market, that's enormous.
Right, but what's interesting is if it continues, and I don't know that it will, but I think what part of what's happening is what you're doing is you're shifting out of the debt model, which was government debt, and into an equity model, which is private corporations. So you're evolving the governance system from one where everything's run by sovereign governments that use bonds to one that's much more corporate-based and is rebalanced globally. So it's not just, you know, the emerging markets, you're gonna rebalance both production and consumption globally. And the, you know, and so part of this is that the percentage control of, you know, consumption in the developed worlds is going down as a significant percentage of the total. You know, and what you're going to say is this is all good because, you know, you've now got a growing middle class globally. It's much more fair in that sense. That's the speech. But there's no doubt about it. You're shifting the financial systems that you've used to manage and govern in the G7 world into the global world. And that's why we're not getting hyperinflation, because that paper is getting soaked up by both the competition of labor globally, as well as just securitizing all of those flows.
Well, but let me just point out something. Let me point out a fundamental trend. And when I say fundamental trend, I mean a 300 or 400 year trend in human society and the way people think and organize themselves. And there's been a trend toward centralization that began about 1600 or 1650. And that trend has concentrated more and more power in the corporate state. And notice I say corporate state because before that time, loyalty in a quote state or nation was given to a private individual, a king, a sovereign. And that changed and the state became a corporate entity over the course of, say, 1650 to 1800. The point I'm trying to make is there was this tendency to centralize power in the middle, not just political power, but every kind of power. And now with one global empire having hegemony over the whole globe, that is the United States, you've reached the peak of that trend of centralization, and the trend is turning and going the other way. So I would say that what they're trying to do in centralizing ownership and control is shows the peak of that movement, not the continuation of that movement. You follow what I'm saying?
Well, here's the thing. I think you and I hope that centralization fails. I mean, I think it's fair to say I don't think centralization is going to work. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work. I mean, one of the, you know, we see eBay splitting off PayPal and Hewlett Packard splitting into two groups. You know, even the corporations are saying it doesn't work. So what I would say is if you look at sort of the global plan in the 90s to centralize ownership and control, mm-hmm. you know, it is completely bogged down in the mud in a variety of different ways, whether, you know, military in the Middle East or, you know, trying to force GMO on India. Because basically, if you look at the fundamental model, it's psychopathic. And, you know, the biggest disagreement I have with the people that I know who have been running this, and I'm not privy, but from what I know of the governance system, they believe in slavery, and that gives me a big problem.
Yes.
So I think you have the human element on planet Earth in a state of complete nauseousness at the perversion of what's going on. You know, I just think in every realm you have at the cultural and spiritual level, you know, an entire planet of human beings saying, you guys are out of your mind. And it's a, you know, it's a revolution of consciousness, if you will. And you see it in all the different political or financial battles that we discuss, but it's coming. And so I think it's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about spiritual warfare, is because so many different people in my network are coming back and saying, will you please talk about it? Because, you know, step one to creating, because I think what's going to happen is we're going to end up with some kind of transformation through this. But to create alternatives, you know, we need to start at the spiritual and then the cultural level. You know, what is the golden rule? How do we live it globally? All of those kind of questions. But I think there's more and more understanding that, you know, we're dealing in a world where we don't see the governance system clearly. There's a complete absence of transparency about an enormous amount of questions, and we've reached a level of ridiculousness, you know, whether it's the financial ridiculousness or any of the other ridiculousness, where people are ready to say, you know something, it's easier to just reinvent everything than to keep pushing the string a little bit further down the road.
Right, but the problem is that those who are centralizing, those who profit from that system, view that as a hostile act. They view as an act of warfare any attempt to try to re-engineer the system or build an alternative system. So they have to view it that way. They have to.
Well, some factions do. Others, I think that's where it gets pretty murky. So, you know, and we could talk about that all day. But there's no doubt to me precious metals is at the heart of this. And if we come back to precious metals, to me, what's really important, you know, what I wrote a post that I keep sending back to everybody, which is, you know, you have a core position in precious metals. And to me, that's insurance. That's for the worst case. And frankly, I don't want Bitcoin. I want gold. I want something I can put in my pocket and walk down the road and they can't read it, see it, take it away. You know, it's mine.
You sound like my wife, Susan. I mean, literally, we were having this same conversation this morning. And she says, when you write that newsletter this month, I want you to talk about gold as insurance. And one of the things about gold that people don't always think of is we live in a world where the state has created a financial police state, a place. Let's face it, if they want to cut off you financially tomorrow, they can cut off all your electronic credits. Gold and silver are the only things that have only financial assets that have value outside of their system.
Right.
And so the only way that you can get something outside of their a value outside of their system is to do it with gold and silver. And the difference between gold and silver and land is what they can't find, they can't steal. I mean, I love the concept of having land or productive assets because, that allows your particular diligence and conscientiousness to flourish. It gives it a place to flourish. But the problem with that is they can come in and seize all that.
But you can always put gold in your pocket and just walk away. So it's funny. I've been trying to figure out there's some kind of major mind control campaign going on using Ebola, and it's frightening. But I've been trying to figure out what are the 20 reasons behind this? Because the word is coming out to investors, you know, ignore this. This is not a practical problem. You don't need to worry about this. But meantime, the media's, you know, got everybody all lathered up about this. And it's always funny to me, Franklin, because here you have chemtrails being sprayed overhead with all this gook in it that could kill you. And no one's concerned about that. But one guy dies in Texas from Ebola and suddenly the world stops and we all have to get hysterical about it. Anyway, so
no question. Yeah, there's no question.
I've been trying to figure out, you know, what's the game here? What's the game? And somebody just posted a comment in response to our wrap up that said, you know, as long as this Ebola thing is going on, I will not use paper money. I will only use digital money. Digital money is the only thing safe as long as Ebola's around. And I thought, oh, they're trying to kill not only dollar bills, but gold coins, because gold coins carry Ebola with them.
Well, you know, it's accurate to say that they're carrying on a warfare against any kind of physical money. I mean, that's been going on for years. But can I add something about this? This is extremely important, and it takes us off in another direction, but I want to talk about Ebola. There's a book that every single one of your readers needs to get a hold of tomorrow and read. I didn't say yesterday. I said tomorrow. And that book is by Thomas Levy, L-E-V-Y. The name of it is Curing the Incurable. Curing the Incurable. And what it's about is about vitamin C, massive dose vitamin C, to treat not only viral and not only bacterial, but also viral infections successfully. Levy talks about a man named Klinner in Reidsville, North Carolina, who in 1948, during the polio epidemic, and you and I are old enough to remember the polio epidemic. I'm older than you are, so I remember as a child, you know, everybody was scared of polio in the 50s because, if you know, it came on suddenly and there was absolutely no cure for it. There was nothing that could be done.
Right.
And usually it progressed and you became paralyzed. They had to put you in an iron lung. And then afterwards, if you lived through all that, you were crippled the rest of your life. What he did was he treated with massive doses of vitamin C, you know, say 24,000 milligrams a day, which is like 24 grams. He treated 60 children with polio, and of those 60, 60 were cured and had no residual effects. Now
is will this heal us from the vaccine they come up with to protect us from?
Seriously, that's true. He points out that this is far better than vaccination because it has no toxic side effects, no drawbacks, but
I'm not worried about any of the viral infections. I'm worried about the vaccines.
Well, that's exactly right. But what I'm saying is he used vitamin C, massive dose vitamin C, to cure viral infections and to prevent viral infections. And he recommends a form of vitamin C called liposomal vitamin C. And if you take that, it prevents you from developing the disease. Well,
right.
Ebola is a viral disease. The end stage of Ebola is massive hemorrhage. Hemorrhage is also a symptom of scurvy because your body is using up huge amounts of vitamin C to fight this viral infection. So you actually develop scurvy, and the hemorrhages are evidence of that. They're a symptom of that. So what I'm saying is all your listeners ought to read this book for themselves and see if liposomal vitamin C doesn't offer them a way to protect themselves and their families from this whole Ebola scare. And there'll be another scare. There'll be a flu scare. You see the same
thing in the newspaper. So last week I calculated 800 people died in car crashes, 10,000 people died of heart disease, and one person died of Ebola in the United States. These are just United States statistics.
The media.
So I want to talk with you next about spiritual warfare because that can protect those 10,000. I think America's dying of a broken heart, and spiritual warfare is one of the most effective things they can learn to get those numbers way, way down, certainly in their own life.
Right. Well, I think you're absolutely right, because the more fearful, the more stressed people are, the more subject they are to disease.
Right.
I mean, here's what our problem is. We have been raised in this enlightenment, this post-enlightenment world, where the only thing that is taken into account is the material world. We have this, quote, scientific, end quote, outlook that says anything that happens outside what we can define, see, and measure is not important. But the actual truth is that man is a creature made of a body and a soul. The two parts go together, so that unseen inward part, the soul, if there's an illness there, a sickness there, it affects the
everything.
Unseen part. It affects everything else.
Okay, well, anything else before we close on precious metals that you want to say, other than it's at the heart of the battle?
Silver's in the same place gold is, and we're either witnessing the last reversal of the whole three-year correction, or there'll be one more leg down, and you'll be able to tell when gold gets to the $1,350 mark, and we'll see what it does there.
Yeah. We're going to put your links to your charts up on the blog. So they'll be part of the precious metals commentary. The one last thing I would say, Franklin, I'm going to put up a link to my core versus investment thing that I always do. But the other thing I will say is I've been amazed, given how dire the charts looked a week ago, the way it's popped up as quickly. And I think that's a very positive sign, very heartening for me. So
it is positive, but the only thing about it is it can fool you. You have to be careful that your hopes don't affect your suspicious outlook. In other words, we still have to see confirmation of.
Right. Well, as a chart matter, you know, it's come down and hit that 1200 line, you know, four times now. And of course, you know, when it does it that many times, if it comes back down and through, then you really could get a breakdown. So.
Right. And that's what I'm fearful of. That's
right.
The bad side. The good side is that it's made this strong reversal and it's really reversing. You know,
right.
The last 3 days I've seen very strong reversal.
Right. Okay. Okay. Franklin, again, thank you very much.
Well, it's always my pleasure.
Thank you.